All right, so you've already visited a little bit around your tables, but I'm just going to give you 2 or 3 minutes right now to make sure that you know everybody around the table. And if you've already done those kind of introductions, then I'm going to give you a question. Now, this can be a softball question. You can answer this and just, one of the things that I would answer this question with is one of the things that that I'm not doing well right now is working out. You could also go deep with this question, whatever you want to do with it. Here's the question. What's something that you know that you should be doing that you're not doing? What's something you know that you should be doing that that you're not doing? Again, not everybody's going to get to answer that, but take 2 or 3 minutes, get to know each other around the table, and if you run out of introduction time, answer that question. All right, let's go ahead and jump in. So you should have at your place a sheet of paper with some scripture on the front and the back. It's out of 2 Samuel. If you don't have one of those, you can walk to the back and somebody will get you one. You also should have some pens. And I'm going to encourage you to grab those pens and as we read, to underline or circle anything that might be interesting to you or to jot notes on the side, just kind of whatever you want to do. Some people don't like this. I'm a big advocate of this. I write in my Bible a lot. I have a hard time just reading and not actually doing something. So when I read really anything, any kind of book, but with the scripture too, I have to be constantly jotting down notes. It helps me to engage more. So if you've never tried that before, I'm going to encourage you to do that this morning. It may feel uncomfortable to you. That's okay. Do it anyway. So let's take a look at 2 Samuel. We're going to jump right in. Okay, right there in the first verse. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle. I don't know if you know that or not, but the spring is the time of year in the ancient Middle East when kings went out to battle. You know how I know that? I only know that because it says that right there. Nothing to do with seminary, no research, it just says it right there. So, if you were up here, you'd be able to see in my Bible, there's a little question mark next to the word time. Because I read that recently and I thought, why in the world is the author telling us that? Who cares? I mean, you know, when you're writing, you tend to only write things that are important. So why would it possibly be important that the springtime is the year that kings go out to battle? I thought, what's going on there? David sent Joab, Joab's one of his generals, with his officers and all of Israel with him. They ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but this is important here. David remained in Jerusalem. Now, some of you know a little bit about David. What is one thing that you know about David? In fact, what is the title that generally comes before David's name? Somebody tell me. King. David is the king. So then I've got a little arrow drawn from my question mark down to David remained, because here in the first verse of this story, we've got a problem. The springtime is when what happens? When kings go to battle. But yet, what is David doing? David, the king, is not going out to battle. It seems to be a problem. So then we know why the author was intentional about telling us that this is the time when kings go out to battle. Because David, who's not only a king, he's supposed to be like the king, like he's God's king. He's supposed to be the great king on the whole earth. He's not going out to battle. So right here at the beginning, we see that David's in a situation where he hasn't done anything wrong, but he has failed to do something right. He hasn't done anything that he wasn't supposed to do, but he has failing to do something that he is supposed to do. It happened, it's kind of ominous, right? It happened late one afternoon. This is when David rose from his couch. What's David doing when his men are out at battle? He's hanging out on his couch. And he was walking about on the roof of the king's house. That's when he saw from the roof a woman bathing. I guess it's also true in the ancient Middle East that women just bathed on roofs. The woman, she was very beautiful. Okay, David, again, at this point has not done anything wrong, right? David is just failing to do something right. David is supposed to be at battle. Instead, he's hanging out on the couch. He's walking around in his roof, and he happens to notice that there's a beautiful woman bathing on the roof next door, right? It's not his fault that she's bathing next door. It's not his fault that he noticed that she was beautiful, nor is it his fault that he noticed that she was naked bathing on the roof next door. But now some things do happen to become David's fault. David sent someone to inquire about the woman. It was reported, this is Bathsheba. She's the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite. Okay, I also have in my notes here, the wife circled. That seems to be important, right? I mean, it's not just that she's Bathsheba, but she's Bathsheba and she's Uriah's wife. You know, I don't know if the person who reported this to David like knew what David was up to, but whoever's reporting this to David wants to be really intentional that he knows this is a married woman. This is a married woman, right? So David sent messengers to go and get her. All right, now it's getting bad. And she came to him, and he lay with her. You can figure out what that means, right? They didn't lay down and, like, cuddle, right? He lay with her. Okay, here's another weird statement. In fact, it's in parentheses. Now she was purifying herself after her period. Okay, again, probably doesn't seem to be that important. Why would the author include it? It becomes pretty important here in just a minute. And then she returned to her house. The woman conceived, and she sent and told David, I am pregnant. Okay, now David has not only done something that he wasn't supposed to do, but he's in trouble. I mean, this is something that you can't just cover up. And now you know why the parenthetical statement about her being on her period was important, right? Why is it important? Well, you know, Uriah just went off to war. I would imagine that he and his lady had a little bit of fun before they went off to war, but it's now been long enough that she has had her period, and she's going to become pregnant, and Uriah is going to know, this isn't my baby. So David's got himself a problem. I think we're going to read more of this in just a second. But I think the way that this story is set up, it tells us something really important for us as men. David didn't set out to do anything wrong. I mean, in fact, the temptation like came his way, like in the form of a woman bathing in the house next door. Temptation came his way in the form of like an SMU girl like running with headphones in like around campus while you were driving this morning, right? Temptation came your way like in the form of like a woman on a business trip. Like some of you are giggling because like you saw that girl. Like I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, right? Temptation comes our way. We don't have to go out and find it. Like it finds us. Here's the thing. David didn't get in this situation because he did anything wrong. David just got in this situation, one, because temptation naturally finds you, but two, because he was failing to do something right. The only reason that David was in a situation where he was able to commit adultery with Bathsheba was because he wasn't at war. This is just a very simple principle that I want to suggest to you this morning. If you're not doing what you should be doing, you're probably going to end up doing what you shouldn't be doing. Does that make sense? I want to focus this morning. I'm glad. I want to focus this morning. It's Jade's little girl. I want to focus this morning on not on what we shouldn't be doing, but on what we should be doing. Because I think as men and as dads, if we focus on what we should be doing, then the rest of it takes care of itself. But if you get into a situation where you're not doing what you should be doing, in that void where you're not doing what you should be doing, it's going to be filled with something else. Does that make sense? All right, so I want you to take just a couple of minutes around your table, and I want you to talk about what are two or three things that you should be doing right now. We talked about this a little bit a minute ago. This is a little bit of a different question. If there were only two or three things that from now until the end of the school year that you could just hit a home run with, I mean, if you wanted to do anything well, you want to do these two or three things well, what are those two or three things that, gosh, if I nailed these things, then everything else is going to fall in line. So why don't you take just like 30 seconds to think about that? What are two or three things that if I could do anything right, this is what I want to do right, and then share some of those with your people around the table. Okay, so let's bring it back in for just a couple minutes. So our former senior pastor here, Mark Craig, how many of y'all came to the church under Mark Craig's teaching? Yeah, a bunch of you. Mark Craig, how many of you came here? Mark was famous for a few things. Mark was famous as a preacher. He was a great preacher, particularly for men. He identified early on in his career that he wanted to preach specifically to men. That's why many of us really connected with him. He was famous because Mark would say anything. I don't know if you ever spent any one-on-one time with him. You never knew what was going to fly out of Mark Craig's mouth. I mean, Mark Craig would say anything. He was also famous for being incredibly efficient with his time. Mark got so much done in so little time. Many of us just envy him. We don't know how he does it. Well, one of Mark's secrets is that he would carry around in his little pocket every day a little note card. You may have even seen it sometimes. Right here, he carried around in his little pocket. And he would have on that note card three or four things, no more than that, that he was going to do that day. And he would come into the office, and he would do those three or four things. And then whenever he was done, he would go home or he would read a book. He would just do those three or four things. And by doing that, he grew our church not only in membership, but also financially in a tremendous way and became one of the best pastors in the country because he knew every day what his three or four things were. There were three or four things that only he, Mark Craig, could do. The rest of the staff could do everything else. And he would nail those every day and he'd go home and he'd come back in with three or four more things. Here's what I want to encourage you guys to do. I want to encourage you guys to get a note card this week and write on it the three or four things that you have just got to hit a home run with this school year. What are the three or four things that, gosh, if you do these and you do nothing else, maybe life's not going to be great, but life's not going to fall apart, especially for you and if you're married, for your wife and for your kids. What are those three or four things that you're going to do and only you can do and you're going to do a great job with it? Because I don't want you to be in the same place that that David was, where David got in trouble, not because he did something wrong, but because he failed to do something right. These are the things that I'm going to make sure that I do. Okay, so let's continue on with this little story here. It takes a little bit of a turn because 1 through 5 is about how David got in trouble. 6 and on is about what David did after he got in trouble. Some of you may be in that place right now. Now, hopefully, some other woman is not pregnant. If that is the case, come and talk to me. We can walk through this together. But maybe you're in a situation where there's something, right? I mean, you have done something that you're ashamed of. You're in some kind of pit. This is how David tries to get out of that pit. So David sent word to Joab. Remember, Joab's his general. Joab is on the front line. David is on his couch in Jerusalem. Send me Uriah the Hittite. You remember who Uriah is, right? That's Bathsheba's husband. Send me Uriah. Send him back from the front line. Send him here to Jerusalem. So Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked Joab, asked how Joab and the people fared and how the war was going. He's just making small talk. Then David said to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. Anybody know why he wants him to wash his feet? Anybody? I mean, this is like seminary stuff here, right? Anybody know why he wants him to wash his feet? Okay, here's the deal. This is a great insight. Okay, this is going to change the way you read certain passages in the Bible. I didn't know this until a few years ago. This is really good. All right, feet is a euphemism in the Old Testament for penis. Okay? So, what does it mean to go down to your house and wash your penis? What's he want him to do? He wants him to go down and think that he knocks his wife up. Why? So that he'll think that the child that is David's is actually his. Now, I'm telling you, you are going to read passages different. Now, it's not true every time that foot is mentioned, right? Right, but there's a story in Ruth where Ruth is trying to like get in with this guy Boaz, and it says that she goes and she lays at his feet, and you think that means that like she lay there like patiently for him to like wake up, and she was like the sweet innocent girl. No. What does it mean? I mean, just think about it. What does it mean? Like, it's no wonder, like, he woke up and he was like, yes, like, you're in. Like, you are under my wing, right? Because she laid at his feet, and he woke up, right? Anyway, okay, moving on. So this is what David wants him to do. He wants him to go wash his penis. Okay. Uriah went out of the king's house, and there followed him a present from the king. I have no idea why. I have a question mark there. I don't know what the present was. But Uriah slept. This is interesting. Uriah slept at the entrance of the king's house with all the servants of the Lord and did not go to his house. So he doesn't go see his wife. When they told David Uriah did not go down to his house, David said to Uriah, "Look, man, you've just come from a journey. Why did you not go down to your house?" Uriah said to David, "The ark in Israel and Judah remains in booths." That means they're in tents. They're encamped against enemies. "And my lord Joab, my general, and the servants, and my lord, they're all camping in the open field. Shall I then go to my house and eat and drink and lie with my wife?" I mean, can't you see him kind of like, whether intentionally or not, maybe he's figured out what's going on. I don't know. But can you see him kind of poking at David here? Because he's saying, look, all of the army is out there in battle. They're staying in tents. They're staying in tents. And you expect me to go sleep in comfort and to sleep with my wife? Because, of course, what does David do it? David is sleeping in comfort, sleeping with Uriah's wife. Uriah is saying, how dare I possibly do that? And David, of course, that's exactly what David's doing. Yeah. Is he in that list, Uriah? I don't know that he is. Check. Let's check afterwards. I don't know if he's in that list or not. That's a great question. There's a list later of 30 mighty men of David. Where were we here? As you live and as your soul lives, I'm not gonna do something like that. And then David said to Uriah, "Remain here today also. I want you to stick around another day, and then tomorrow you can go back." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day. And on the next day, David invited him to eat and to drink in his presence and made him drunk. And in the evening, he went out to lie on his couch with the servants of the Lord. But still, even when he's drunk, he did not go down to his house. David's exacerbated. And in the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it. These five words right here I underlined, some of the most vile words in the Bible. By the hand of Uriah. He sent this letter by the hand of Uriah. Uriah carries this letter, and here's what the letter said. "Set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting, and then draw back from him so that he may be struck down and die." So Uriah is carrying a letter with his own death sentence in it to his general from his king. As Joab was besieging the city, he assigned Uriah to the place where he knew there was the most violent warriors. The men of the city came out and fought with Joab, and some of the servants of David among the people fell. Uriah the Hittite was killed as well. So David, when David gets in trouble, when he's done something that he wasn't supposed to do, and he's about to get caught for it, what does David do? Here's the deal. Sometimes when you end up doing something that you're not supposed to do, you end up doing more things that you're not supposed to do. And the first thing is, when we're not doing what we're supposed to do, we end up doing what we're not supposed to do. And then, as many of us have experienced, once we're to a place where we're already doing what we're not supposed to do, we end up doing even more things that we're not supposed to do. And that's where David found himself. So here's a second question that I hope will be rattling around in your brains this week, is be really honest with yourself about what is your knee-jerk reaction when you get in trouble. When you get in trouble, what's your go-to strategy? What do you end up doing? We talked about this a little bit in the chapel, the service that I lead on Sunday mornings this past week, in a little bit of a different context, but I think that it applies here also. What I'm about to say is hyperbolic. It's an exaggeration. Don't tweet this out. I'm trying to make a point here, so I'm going to exaggerate a little bit. I think when everything begins to hit the fan, we tend to do one of three things. We tend to hit the bottle, hit our dog, or hit our knees. When everything hits the fan, we tend to do one of those three things. And I don't mean one of those three things specifically, but kind of a category. These are kind of categories. One of the things that many of us do is that we hit the bottle. And what I mean by that is maybe literally we hit the bottle of pills or we hit the bottle of booze, but we hit something that distracts us from the reality of the situation. We get into a situation that we can't get ourselves out of, and what we do is we try to self-medicate in some way that removes us from the reality of the situation. This is one of the reasons that pornography is so powerful, because rather than dealing with the reality of our real relationship, it's easier to deal with a virtual relationship that we get sucked into. This is the reason that so many men, one of the reasons that so many men end up in adulterous relationships, because rather than dealing with the problems of a real relationship, we collapse ourselves into a fake, a false relationship that is cheaper and that is easier and that gives us a rush, but that rush, of course, fades eventually. I think when we get in trouble, the first category of things that we tend to do is we do something that's a form of escapism. It helps us to remove ourselves from the reality of the situation, whether that's alcohol or another woman, or for some of us, it's just as simple and it seems as innocent as our phones, where rather than actually dealing with our families, we suck ourselves into our phones, whether that's email or whatever else it is, and we get stuck into that. The second category of things is we kick our dog. Now, maybe you literally hit your dog, and if you do that, you should stop. Maybe you literally hit other people, and if you literally hit other people, and the statistics tell us that there are men in this room that do that, then you should come and talk to me afterwards. You're probably not going to want, now everybody who comes talk to me afterwards, you're going to think, everybody else thinks that he's an abuser, right? That's not, look, email me, right? You can come to my, but maybe it's not literally hitting somebody. Maybe it's what David did. It's lashing out. One of the ways that we try to get ourselves out of holes is by lashing out at the people that are around us. Maybe that's physical, maybe it's verbal, I don't know. And then the last one is that we hit our knees. What I mean by that is that we fall down, we admit, I can't get myself out of this hole, and we look up and we remember that there is someone who can get us out of this hole. So be really honest with yourself this morning. When it hits the fan for you, what do you tend to do? Are you somebody who tends to try to escape to a bottle or to another relationship or to something else? Are you someone who lashes out at the people around you? Or are you someone who hits your knees and says, look, I'm in a hole, but I'm not going to dig this sucker any deeper? You're probably a combination of the three, but my bet is that you lean more heavily on one of the three than the other. So I want to give you a couple minutes to talk about that in your group. When it hits the fan, what do you tend to do? Now, again, you just got to know some of these guys. I'm not suggesting this morning that you bare all of your deep secrets, but you can begin to have this conversation. And if you don't begin to have it, then you're never actually going to process through it in a deep way. And if you're here this morning because you want to be a great dad, and I think that's why you are here, the most important thing about being a good dad is by dealing with our own personal issues. Okay, one of the things I like to say is that if we're not dealing with our issues, we're the only person around us who's not dealing with our issues. If you don't deal with your issues, then your kids are going to have to deal with your issues. So take just a minute. When it hits the fan, what do you tend to hit? All right, let's wrap this up. All right, in the last few minutes, we're going to read that last little bit. But after you write down the three things on your note card, the things that you just want to knock out of the park this school year, I'm going to encourage you to also, on a separate sheet of paper, just write down what you know your tendency is when you get in trouble. What do you tend to do? I tend to retreat into work. Just write it down. Own it. I tend to retreat into work. I tend to retreat into other relationships. Maybe you don't want to write that down. You don't want somebody to accidentally find that, right? Write down what it is that you tend to do, and I think writing stuff down helps you to own it. Okay, let's read this last little bit. This is how David gets out of this situation, okay? Here in chapter 12. And the Lord sent Nathan to David. He, that's Nathan, came to him, that's David, and said to him, he tells him a little story. There were two men in a certain city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had lots of flocks and lots of herds. But the poor man had nothing but one little ewe lamb, which he had bought. He brought it up, and it grew up with him and with his children. It used to eat of his meager fare and drink from his cup and lie at his bosom. That's really weird. And it was like a daughter to him. Now there came a traveler to the rich man, and he was loath to take one from his own flock or herd to prepare for the wayfarer. They were required if somebody came to feed them. He didn't want to use his own flock to feed this man who had come to him. But he took the poor man's one little lamb that was like a daughter to him, and he prepared that for the guest who had come to him. David's anger was greatly kindled against this man. He said to Nathan, "As the Lord lives, the man who has done this deserves to die. He shall restore the lamb fourfold," give the poor man four lambs, "because he did this thing, and because he had no pity." And one of the greatest turns in the scripture, Nathan said to David, "You are that man. You are the one who stole from the poor in order to build yourself a rich man up. You stole Uriah's wife." And that's the beginning of David turning this situation around, is when all of a sudden he has a friend look him in the eye and say, "You are that man. You need to own this." And then we're not going to read it today. David then writes Psalm 51, one of the greatest poems about repentance that has ever been written. "Give me a clean heart, O God, and renew your spirit inside of me." Here's what I want to ask you. Do you have a Nathan? Do you have someone who is willing to come to you and say, "You are that man. I know what you're doing, and you got to turn this around"? Do you have somebody who's willing to do that? And do you have somebody that you are being vulnerable enough with, they know enough about you to have the knowledge to be able to do that? So that's the third little list that I want you to make. The first is what you want to do this year, knock out of the park. The second is your knee-jerk reaction when you get in trouble. And then the third is, who are you going to go to when you get in trouble? Because maybe you've got a close enough relationship that they're going to see this and they're going to come after you. But the odds are, especially in our society where we're so closed up, you're going to have to go to somebody and say, "Hey, this is what I did. I need you to walk through this with me." This year, don't let this calendar year, 2015, go by without you having somebody that when it hits the fan that you can go and talk to. And I would go ahead and write that person's name down. You don't even have to ask their permission. But so that you just know, when I get in trouble next time, I am going to Dr. Bob's office and I'm going to tell Dr. Bob what's going on. Who is that person? Who is that person for you? So I'm going to encourage you to write those three things down. And I'm going to encourage you just to have those questions be rattling around in your mind. Because here's the deal. If we want to be great dads, the key to being a great dad is to being a great man. And the key to being a great man is not worrying about all the things that we're not supposed to do. We're so inundated with all the things we're not supposed to do. Because the truth is, if those handful of things that we know we should be doing, if we do those, then everything else is going to fall in line. So figure out what those things are for you. I hope the faith is one of those things. I hope that if you're married, your wife is one of those things. And one of the things on your to-do list is your wife, right? I hope that that spending time with your kids is one of those things. But you got to make that list. I'm going to close with just this last note. I don't even think it connects with anything else. But one of the things that I'm just noticing about myself and noticing with the men that I meet with is I have never met a man. And maybe these men are out there, maybe you know them, but I've never met them. I have never met a man who was a great husband and a terrible father. Just never met that person. I've met lots of men who were great fathers and terrible husbands. But I've never met someone who was a great husband and a terrible dad. So if you're married and you can only do one thing this year, I'm going to encourage you at the top of that list to make that your wife. Put her at the top of your to-do list. Because if you do that right, the parenting thing is going to fall in line. And I think a lot of the other things in our life are going to fall in line too. If you want to have a more extended conversation about what that looks like, I'm certainly willing and open, available to meet with any of you guys anytime. Let me know if we can do that. But so are a bunch of these guys around the table. I hope that you'll be back next month. We've got a great speaker lined up for the next 2 months. I hope that that you'll be here. And I hope that you'll consider inviting some other people. I hope that maybe you'll even consider taking the step of being a table host, where you are intentional about inviting six other guys up here, and we'll give you a little table with your name on it, and invite six guys to sit at your table. But I'm glad you guys are here this morning. Hope it's been helpful, and I hope that you have a great day at work today. We'll see you on Sunday, hopefully, but next month also. Have a good day.